Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. This is my distinct privilege to welcome, on her first official visit to the United States and to New York in particular, the newly appointed Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, the Right Honourable Teresa Villiers, Member of Parliament. You're very welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And this is a different kind of trip for you. This is not, you're not on the sightseeing. As a matter of fact, those who handled your schedule made sure that you weren't even going to get to do anything other than biz.
Oh, I'm afraid it's a packed schedule full of work and meetings, so I'm a bit disappointed that there isn't any shopping involved, but I'll just have to come back again soon.
That's it, and don't tell them at all that you're coming. You know, just nip out. Anyway, an illustrious career, and maybe go back to college, go back to your schooling, and what was it that, what was the magnet that brought you into public service and into, you know, an area that quite a number of people would say, especially the male chauvinists would say, we're not going to see a day when a female will be Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Just give us a little bit of background.
Well, I think most people who go into politics and public life, I want to make a difference. That's what motivates me. I think what really engaged my sort of early interest in politics was issues around the economy, about the importance of you having a government that's responsible, that has sound public finances, mm-hmm. that creates the right conditions for enterprise and wealth creation and jobs and prosperity.
You grew up in London.
I did, yes, in North London.
And was that, and you went to school in North London?
I did, yes.
And again, what was the environment like during that period? In terms of, I know you've mentioned the economy, but was there a sense of discontent? How different was it than what we're going through here at the moment?
Well, I suppose I sort of growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was quite a sort of unstable time politically and economically, and I think it made a significant impression on me that, you know, the United Kingdom, which seemed to have an economy that was falling apart in the late 70s, had it put back together essentially by the Conservative government of the 1980s. They took some difficult decisions. It was a controversial period in our history, but I think it was essential that we address the terrible troubles we had, for example, with trade unions, who I think had got completely out of touch with their membership, and the sort of irresponsible approach they took to essentially bringing the country to a halt in the late 70s. Demonstrated that they were wielding too much power, and so the confrontations that the Thatcher government had with them, I think, were difficult, but ultimately put our country back to work again. And also the structural and economic reforms of the Conservative years were crucial in making the UK a competitive place again, when, you know, many people seem to assume in the 1970s that it was an endless downward slide that we were on. So, you know, there were, I think a considerable amount was achieved in that period.
You served for 6 years or thereabouts as a member of the European Parliament representing London. What did you, what was your reaction, first of all, with the, you know, was there any part of you that had reservations about accepting that role, and if so, had you envisaged some 6 years on the job?
I define myself as a Eurosceptic. I have, I think, significant concerns about the direction that some would like to take Europe and the degree of political integration that's been driven in the European Union, the extent to which it's become more and more difficult for individual countries to take their own decisions. And I was of that view before I was an MEP, and I must say after 6 years, I had even graver concerns, actually. I think it's because we've got a very lively debate in the UK, because when the decision was initially made to join the European Union, I think the general population understood it to be a matter of economics and trade. I don't think they really appreciate the extent to which it involves quite strong political ties. And so that's one of the reasons why the UK Conservatives believe that we do need to look again at whether there's more that we can decentralise in Europe, whether there are powers which have been transferred and decisions now taken in Brussels, which actually it would make more sense to return to national capitals to make the decisions on.
Many countries in Europe are obviously struggling with, and there is a lot of unrest still, particularly within the Eurozone. There, from a UK perspective, is that worsening? Is it more of the same? Is it are things getting closer? What's your read?
Well, it's a difficult situation for us in the UK. I mean, we're obviously really, really keen to see the Eurozone fix its economic problems because they are our biggest export market. And until they start to recover, it's very difficult for us to. Although our economy went back into growth today, so that is some good economic news we're delighted about. Progress is very slow in the Eurozone. It was a huge experiment to create a single currency without a single fiscal policy or a single banking system to back it. And that tension has, unfortunately, in the last few years become very apparent. And it does seem clear that you need to find a way for the Eurozone countries to work more closely together and look to see whether they can stand together behind the Eurozone banks in order to deal with this very persistent sovereign debt crisis. And they have, to be fair, started to make some progress, but there is no very obvious solution in sight in the near term. But I think the recent discussions have made more progress than has been the case over the last couple of years. But it's incredibly difficult to get so many diverse governments, lots of different political parties all agreeing on what would be quite fundamental changes. And these were risks in relation to the single currency that I and many others in the UK raised when it was created back in the 90s. That's one of the reasons why the UK didn't join, because we thought if you join a single currency sooner or later, you're going to find it difficult to make your own decisions on tax and spending. Mm-hmm. And is that exactly how it's come out.
Is that a political issue in the UK, or has does everybody kind of agree that it was the right decision to make?
Oh, joining the euro isn't a political issue in the UK. I think it's generally accepted that the UK would never join. I think it would be inconceivable. Mm-hmm. So it's not a live issue at all anymore. Mm-hmm. It was back in the late 90s, but not at the moment.
When you returned and then were selected almost as soon as the election was over by David Cameron, being again, well, let's go before that, actually, because you had to, back in 2005, when you returned, you were then shadow secretary for David Cameron's party for the initially for the Treasury and then on to transport. that was a off the diving board into the pool coming back from. That was a huge challenge.
It was a big responsibility at a very early stage. After 7 months, David Cameron put me in his shadow cabinet and appointed me a shadow chief secretary, which is the number two to the shadow chancellor on the economic brief.
Uh-huh.
And so I really enjoyed working with George Osborne, who is our current chancellor, who was mm-hmm. then our shadow chancellor, on developing the Conservatives' economic policy. And another task that you face in that job is the scrutiny of the government's annual finance bill, which mm-hmm. is well known as one of the most technical and grueling and exhausting tasks in Parliament. And my first one nearly killed me, but I just about survived it.
Yeah. You don't make many new friends in those areas, and those that you do make, you know, feel is coming to them. It's a rough area.
Well, yes, being Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury involves saying no to all your colleagues who want to say anything that might mm-hmm. involve spending money if we're actually elected to government. So you do become a bit of a bit of a policeman for unfunded spending commitments. But my colleagues were very patient with me when I would ring them up to nag them about a speech they might have made, which might be construed as involving a spending commitment.
Now, just for the benefit of those who may not know this, is that actually you have a constituency, you're a member of Parliament, and you have to keep your eye on the ball there as well.
I do.
And obviously you did well there because you were just re-elected last year, 2010 actually. Switching from the Treasury to transport, was that an easier portfolio? Was that...
And it was a different portfolio, but there are lots of overlaps between the two because of the key role that improving our transport system has mm-hmm. in economic growth. And
of course, you knew where the money was, so...
that does help. But and actually, one of the things that the coalition government in the UK at the moment is really focused on is improving our transport system as part of its strategy on economic growth. So it's announced very significant investment in improving the rail network and the road network. And we're expanding our railways in a way which is unprecedented since the Victorian era, actually. It's a bigger programme of rail improvements mm-hmm. than at any time for 100 years. And actually, there are more people in the UK travelling by rail than at any time since the 1920s. So there was some, the coalition takes really seriously the importance of improving our transport system.
When Owen Paterson, it appeared for some time that he might in fact be the last Secretary of State to Northern Ireland. Of course, we could say the same going back as far as the last 20 years. When that position came up and when Owen Paterson, who was actually, I think, very much lauded and made a lot of friends in Northern Ireland, was considered to be, very fair. And so when he went on to become, he's now heading the Environment, Minister for the
yes.
Environment. When that position opened up, and when you, when David Cameron says, "Listen, do I have a deal for you or what?" You know, what was your initial reaction to it?
I was very excited. I really was absolutely delighted. It's such a great honour. And because you never know in advance of a cabinet reshuffle, you know, what might happen. And I have to say, I had kind of speculated on whether, you know, the Northern Ireland job might be one, you know, that I would be considered for. And I certainly had it on my list of ones that would be really great to get the opportunity to do. So, I mean, it's such a great place. People are so friendly. Mm-hmm. It's a tough job, but one that allows you to look sort of across the board at different areas of policy, so you get a mm-hmm. you get a feeling for, government activity right across the board, though thankfully now the devolution settlement has worked well, you're not mm-hmm. generally taking decisions on a wide range of policy matters, but there are lots of areas where I'm keen to work with the Northern Ireland Executive, for example, on boosting the economy in Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. which is one of the big, big challenges that we now face.
Another challenge that is obviously, we could almost say, peculiar to Northern Ireland is that the traditions, the political issues can hardly be separated from what everybody is in agreement with, and that is a strong economy and get on with it. Were you at all apprehensive that you may be coming into an area which your predecessors had developed a degree of comfort zone? Was that of concern?
I'm not sure I'm really understanding your question. I mean, I've huge regard for Owen Paterson and the work that he did for Northern Ireland. He was a passionate supporter of Northern Ireland matters, so I'm not sure I would see that he had a particular comfort zone. I think all of my predecessors recognised that, you know, the big political issues to be addressed in Northern Ireland, right. many of which, thankfully, have been resolved through the peace process, but there remain, you know, big questions to resolve, particularly about ensuring that we can rebalance the Northern Ireland economy, because mm-hmm. it has been for many years very dependent on public sector funding, and like every other government across the world, mm-hmm. the public finances are stretched, and we really want to boost the private sector in Northern Ireland to create jobs in the private sector, and that is something that I'm keen to be a part of, and the UK government is also very focused on that.
Now, you obviously are on the political makeup and on the political front in Northern Ireland, it must have been disturbing that at the time that you were of your appointment, all hell was breaking loose in Northern Ireland at the time, as I doubt if it had anything to do with your appointment, but
actually it was.
There are some areas, and you were very upfront, I believe, in saying, you know, that you were, you know, keenly aware, I'm paraphrasing, but fully acknowledged that there are. You know, divisions that have been traditionally there, and that you're equally committed, you know, to smoothing over or to continue. So it's not as if, whereas actually the UK most recently has, at least we are of the opinion that jobs, money, security, you know, preserving the economy at a time when Europe in general is having you know, a great amount of difficulty, that again you aren't shying away from the fact that there are some great political, not only on the political front but actually in the traditions, people are just getting used to it. Obviously, progress is tremendous, but there are times when we really have to, say a prayer that this isn't, that, you know, the bottom has been falling out of something, however rare they might be.
Well, you're right. There are still quite significant divisions in Northern Ireland society. You're right that a huge amount has been achieved with the peace process. I mean, I think it's fantastic that an entire generation has now grown up since the first ceasefires were put in place. But it's also a sadness that there are so many so-called peace walls dividing communities still. Mm-hmm. And this is something that David Cameron, you know, highlighted his interest in when he was giving a speech to the Northern Ireland Assembly last year, and, you know, calling, like many others, for progress towards a genuinely shared future involving, you know, both main traditions, rather than a shared out future with resources and benefits kind of allocated and divided between communities. And the Northern Ireland Executive doing
that, some... Yeah, sorry,
go ahead.
Secretary. How much of that can you attribute to economic differences, those who feel that perhaps they're not getting the fair share of the new progress that has been made on the economic front? Are there still people who feel like they were never in the game to begin with, and that things will always be thus?
Well, I think there is perhaps the problem is at its most intense in some of the lower income communities, and so that makes it all the more important to drive forward with economic prosperity. But I also think that there's a role for the Northern Ireland Executive in working actively to engage hard to reach communities and to ensure that they feel that they have benefited from the peace process.
Yeah, I think that if we've all kind of come to an understanding, which is not peculiar to Northern Ireland. And if you don't have a job, if you don't have prospects, it really has very little to do with your religion. It has little to do with anything other than the fact that you have to feel that somehow society hasn't done the right thing. And whereas we're light years away from when those would look at Northern Ireland and say, well, that's the Protestants and the Catholics and all kinds of visions and images of, you know, defending the faith and so forth. Again, many areas of Northern Ireland, both in the traditions, have a relatively high percentage of those who have not seen other than peace. They haven't seen really an awful lot of benefit from Northern Ireland. Is that?
Well, I mean, I feel very strongly that everyone in Northern Ireland has benefited from the achievements of the peace process. People lived their lives in a way which would have been inconceivable back in the 70s and 80s. But you're right, I think it's important to try and ensure that the benefits of political stability and economic prosperity are, you know, that we see, you know, a whole range of the community able to access them. And I genuinely think that the Northern Ireland Executive is doing some really impressive work here. I think they're very interested, for example, on what they can do through the education system to try and address some continuing divisions in society by, for example, getting schools to work together to have joint projects, strong links, so that bringing different schools together can help reach across traditional sectarian divides in a way which I think is very positive.
One of the hot issues over here is and has been obviously the issue of the now infamous Boston tapes, which most of my listeners would know has the potential of actually creating havoc with the peace process in Northern Ireland. To what degree will you be involved in either trying to mediate or to try to make some sense out of something that is that horrific to begin with?
Well, in terms of the Boston tapes, actually it would be inappropriate for me to be involved in that. I mean, what happened essentially was the police service in Northern Ireland took a decision that they wanted to access mm-hmm. some of these tapes. And
much to the chagrin of quite a number of people who felt that perhaps that was more of a political decision and we could have done without it.
Well, I mean, precisely the point I'm making, it was an operational decision for the police, which is why I think it would be very inappropriate for me to interfere for political reasons. They felt they wanted to see these tapes as part of their investigation, and actually I think it would be very damaging for confidence if I were to wade in mm-hmm. and seek to tell the police in Northern Ireland how they should choose to investigate their own cases. I think that would be very damaging. Obviously, there's a court process which is underway in various fora, and ultimately it'll be resolved through those legal means. Right. It's not for politicians to start treading on the toes and directing the police as to how they should conduct their investigation.
Let me ask you about, and I know that this is a flying visit, and your handlers are once again trying to slip my throat here, but I'm trying to ignore them. But first of all, you're very welcome here. But I do want to ask you about your relationship when you meet the the devolved government leaders, and many of those is this something that is do you have a feeling that you're very welcome, but wait a minute, we have an agenda as soon as you get a chance, you know, we'd like to go in and have a chat with you. Do you get that feeling that there are those who may want to get your particular attention, and how do you handle that as Secretary of State for Northern Ireland?
Well, everyone's been very welcoming, very friendly, and I've had a lot of really useful discussions with both politicians in Northern Ireland and the business community. You're right, though. There are many people who have agenda, have points to raise, but mm-hmm. but actually I find it really useful to hear their perspective, because a big part of my job is making sure the voice of Northern Ireland is heard very strongly at the cabinet table, and so resolving those concerns and ensuring that the decisions we take in London are, you know, in many instances they need to be tempered and amended to apply to the specific circumstances of Northern Ireland. So I'm happy to hear the points mm-hmm. raised with me by people in Northern Ireland, because it's a very important part of my job to make sure that those get passed on to my colleagues in government in London.
I want to welcome you, and whenever you're in New York, you have a choice. You can either come here or you can run the risk that we'll badmouth you because you didn't bother. You're very welcome.
It's been great to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
Thank you. Friends, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Teresa Villiers, and you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA.